On Sunday, March 9th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will offer the second installment as we look at the perspectives of four different women during Women's History Month. This week's guest is vocalist, guitarist, and mandolin player Catherine Russell. That's Sunday, March 9th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Bring it back. To WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. Tonight's guest is Catherine Russell, as mentioned on the promotion. And you should expand your... Well, considering that Catherine Russell has sung with practically, well, all kinds of folks, doing all kinds of music, she's a versatile musician. So there will be different types of music. Varying types of music going on tonight. And that's the kind of thing that can happen based on the versatility of the performer, of the guest. And Catherine Russell is that kind of person. So stay tuned. Oh, we will also focus on Catherine Russell's latest that was released on February 14th. Was it 14th? No, 11th. Excuse me. February 11th this year. Bring It Back. So stay tuned for What's This Now? I want some sugar. In my bowl.
there ain't nothing shaking. When the dawn starts breaking, with me over here.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and my guest on the line is...
Catherine Russell.
Catherine Russell, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Joyce. I appreciate it.
First off, I'd like to thank Paul. Paul is also a writer, isn't he?
He is a writer. He's a songwriter, and actually I co-wrote a tune with him on my first album, and
right.
then did one of his tunes called November on my, let's see, probably my third album.
November and your
that would be Inside His Heart of Love. That is correct. I have to look myself.
Well, thank you so much. And that's Paul Kahn, by the way. We'll give him a last name and a complete identity.
Yes, Paul Kahn.
Who also acts as your manager, is that a secret?
No, that is true. Okay. That's absolutely true, yes.
And let me say this, get this out of the way. Your father.
Yes.
Now, his name is spelled L-U-I-S.
Yes.
Russell.
Yes.
And he was born in Panama.
He was born in Panama. You can say Louis. They say Luis down there.
Okay. That always made me feel unsettled. I looked at the spelling. I was like, why do they keep calling him Louis? And
I mean, you know, it was Louis, as I say it to fellow musicians and in this country, and then it's Luis down in Panama. So
okay.
Both ways work.
Excellent. I just want to let listeners know we're sort of continuing in the vein of musicians who are Panamanian. We had Alex Blake, the bassist, on recently.
Yes.
We've had Pili Cobham on as well. So
excellent.
Yay, Panama.
Yes. Yay, Panama.
Now, your father, Luis, I will call him Luis if you don't mind.
That's fine.
Your father, Luis Russell, he was the musical director with Louis Armstrong, right?
Yes, from 1935 to about 1943. He was Louis Armstrong's musical director, primary arranger, and actually what had happened was that Louis Armstrong basically took over my father's orchestra when he returned to New York in 1935, and then they went on to do a lot of recording for the Decca label. So there is a great collection of Louis Armstrong material from that period, and that's pretty much my dad's arranging and collection.
Is that his Louisiana Swing Orchestra that he took over, or was that another incarnation of orchestras that your father had?
It was, you know, there were many incarnations. I mean, there's so many, but it was a lot of the same members of all those other, you know, Louis Russell orchestras with other horn players. Of course, it was a bigger orchestra at that point, but many of the same people that he had started off in New Orleans working with in the 20s when they basically were the rhythm section, you know, Pops Foster and all of those guys from the 20s. So a lot of the same personnel that had worked together for many years.
Just like some magic potion, you fill me with emotion. You control my very soul. You've got me voodoo. You knew the goddess Venus would start this love between us. You inspired me with desire. You've got me voodoo. You knew you had the power and even picked the hour when the full moon was up above. I was hypnotized when I looked into your eyes. My heart was filled with love. Just like the siren Circe, you've got me at your mercy. Always yours to have and hold. Mama, you got me voodoo. Thank you.
the garbage man. In the morning, stick out your hand. Here comes the garbage man. In the evening, stick out your hand. Here comes the garbage man.
I understand that your father transitioned when you were 9?
7.
Do you have
yes.
any memories of him?
Oh, very good. Very vivid memories. Very vivid memories. You know, my childhood was a very happy one, and he was always, I just remember him being very dapper all the time. He was always dressed very well, even in the house. And,
wow.
And pants were creased, and
wow.
And shirts were you know, laundered at the Chinese laundry, and,
yeah.
you know, crisp and starched, and he always looked great, and always had a smile on his face, and he was a good friend to people, and he and Louis Armstrong remained friends until his passing, and he was always nice to my little friends, too, so, you know, I remember that about him, and he was a home movie fanatic, so we have a lot of home movie footage of the family and Louis Armstrong gatherings and so forth, and he used to, I just remember vividly that he used to sit and splice film all
wow.
the time. So he would sit at his splicing machine and he'd be editing
wow.
all the time. And then he also did a lot of practicing because we always had a grand piano in the house, so he practiced classical music.
Now, was that his main instrument?
Yes,
just
piano
had
was his main
okay.
instrument. Yes, okay. He played several instruments, but that was his main instrument.
What else did he play?
Well, my grandfather was a music teacher and
oh.
a church organist,
oh.
so... So I think that my dad was trained in violin, and I'm not remembering what else, but maybe guitar and, you know, a few instruments. And I know I've got that written down someplace, but I know he was trained in a few different instruments.
Just take time to love one another, all the world would be as one. Black man, white man, working together, no more fighting to be done. Yellow, red man, dancing together, yes, the world will be as one. And yellow, yes, the world will be as one. Black man, white man, red man, and yellow, yes, the world will be as one. Cookie, Mossy, we'll be together.
Your mom. Yeah, I want to get the parents out of the way. Your mom.
Yes,
your mother,
Carlene Ray.
Yay! Among other things, she played with the International Sweethearts of Rhythm.
Yes, that is correct. That was an all-female swing orchestra in the 1940s during the Second World War and comprised of African American, Caucasian, and Asian, I believe, members. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was during the rise of female instrumentalists when the men were at war. So that was really the heyday of that. So she was with that orchestra maybe for a little under 2 years, I believe.
Did they ever record? Did she record?
They did. They did record. She did not record with them because she was not an original member, but I want to say she played guitar and sang also with the orchestra. But I think she told me at one time that she had done a few sides with them, but it didn't really come out as well as she would have liked. And it was also just about to be during the recording ban in the late 40s. So I think that a lot of things got curtailed, you know, because of that.
Recording ban? Enlighten us.
Yes, yes. The and you know, forgive me if I don't get all these facts straight, but the union had banned musicians from recording, and I'm not remembering all the details of that, but it might have been in 1948, 49.
Okay.
So so there weren't a lot of recordings made at that point. Yeah. So it might, I think it lasted maybe for 18 months or something like that.
I'm going to have to investigate that. I actually.
Yeah, and luckily these days things are easy to look up. So
this is true. That's actually something that I've noticed about your recordings. It's like I've had to, it's a lesson in musicology of a particular period.
I've gotten so much more history since I've been out of school, really. So these days, it's really, you know, not everything is on the internet, but there are many things that are. So it's really great and wonderful to be able to YouTube things and to at least get a general history and knowledge of different subjects and songwriters and little history of different people, and then, you know, you can always get the books on them. So that's
sure.
what I do. I'll get my general history from the internet, and then I'll see what actual books I can find, you know.
Sure. Now, back to your mother. She
yes.
also recorded with Mary Lou Williams.
Yes, she did. She actually was responsible for helping Mary Lou Williams finish recording Mary Lou's Mass.
Ah, okay. Yes.
Back in the 70s. And then also she was responsible, I think, for helping Miss Williams gather the choral singers for those record dates. And then she had a few solos as well.
Yes, she did.
And
she played bass on Mary Lou's Mass. And she... This is my favorite of hers. My favorite that she sings on there is Our Father.
Our Father, who art in
thank you.
beautiful.
I wish it were longer.
So beautiful. So beautiful. Yes, I know. It just, but it kind of says what it says, and then it's complete, you know,
yeah.
And then actually I produced my mom, I'm happy to say, when she was in her 80s,
mm-hmm.
and she re-recorded the two pieces, Lazarus and Our Father, that she had done for Mary Lou's Mass, so
oh,
we actually
wow.
have a few versions of those now.
Selfish rich man who clothed himself in purple and fine linen. There also was a beggar man named Lazarus who laid at the gate of the rich man's door, full of sores and hungry, begging crumbs from the rich man's table. Even his dogs came to lick his sores. The rich man showed no pity to Lazarus' plea, and scorn was Lazarus' lot. And God took pity on poor Lazarus and gave him peace. He sent his angels to carry poor Lazarus into the bosom of Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried, and as he burned in hell, he saw the beggar man Lazarus safe in the bosom of Abraham. Father, send Lazarus to cool my parching tongue, 'cause I didn't mean all the misery I've caused and all the bad things I have done. Have mercy on me, Father, send Lazarus to cool my tongue, 'cause I didn't mean all the misery I've caused and all the bad things I have done. But the Lord said, son, in your time you received all the good things in life, but poor Lazarus, beggar, received nothing but pain and strife. Now Lazarus is comforted, and you are burning in the halls of flame, and there's no way for you to cleanse your deeds, for God never knew your name. Lazarus, 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 cool my parching tongue, 'cause I didn't mean all the misery I've caused and all the bad things I have done. Father, 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 send Lazarus to my house, that he may warn them about the flame and what it's all about. Then Abraham said, they have Moses, let them hear his cry, for if they don't repent their evil ways, they will surely die. Lazarus, 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 I didn't mean all the misery I've caused and all the bad things I have done.
It available?
It is available on CD Baby.
Okay.
Yeah, and it is called Carly Rae Vocal Sides.
Oh my gosh, yay!
So that was released in 2013, happy to say. And she really basically picked all the material, which were a mixture of standard spirituals and these two songs that she recorded with Mary Lou Williams. And then I got to sing also a couple of tunes on the album with her. So it's a very nice, basically a jazz album with some spirituals on there. So
you recorded together on your release, Strictly Romancin'.
Yes, we have a tune together on that, which is He's All I Need. I'm looking at these jackets here. Yes.
Yes.
And that was originally a duet by Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Sister Marie Knight back in the 1940s.
Nice.
Shepherd,
Yeah, Sister Rosetta Tharpe. It's like she was a rockin' guitarist, but she was also a soulful singer.
Well, she did everything. You know, jazz, blues, gospel, and she was happy to do everything, you know, because she didn't see the separation in that. She just wanted to make music and make people happy with it. And her mother also was a great singer, so which I discovered through listening to her. So, you know, I just love that. She was amazing.
Yeah.
Marie Knight was primarily a gospel singer back in the 40s, and she had a few hits back then. And her partner really was, you know, her singing partner that did a lot of recording together was Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Mm-hmm. So if you go back to there, they're not easy to find, but you can find Marie Knight recordings from back then, and they swing. They actually swing, so it's gospel that swings. And then she also did a tribute to Reverend Gary Davis, produced by the great multi-instrumentalist Larry Campbell, and that was in the, let me see, maybe 6 or 7 years ago now. So I actually got to meet Sister Marie Knight and did a few duets with her on that album. So that was her last recording before her passing.
Well, you also work with Larry Campbell on your recordings as well.
Yes, he produced Sentimental Streak, the second album, and we got to do that up at Levon Helms' place in Woodstock, New York. And it was really, an amazing experience. As soon as I got up to Levon's place the first time and was going to a midnight ramble, I knew everybody in the band anyway, but I met Levon, and I'd been a fan of his since the 60s, and he said, well, you know, if you want to come on in and record, you know, just try it out, see how you like it. So he took complete care of me, and it was just a dream, you know, to record there, and then I actually got to do some work with him and his band, too. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
Now, I'm glad that I'm also talking to you after the release of 20 Feet from Stardom, the film about background singers and the like.
Yes, yes. I'm very glad they made that film.
Yeah, and I guess you had a similar experience. You were singing background for quite a while.
Yes, I mean, the difference is probably, you know, I know so many people in that film, and it was great to see them on the big screen, see them interviewed, and get to know them even better, you know. The difference with me, though, is that I didn't have a major label deal, you know. Like, all of those folks had major label recording contracts.
I see.
And were misled, and whatever had happened to them, you know, in the process of that. So that was just kind of a product of the times of major labels signing a lot of artists and then only backing a few of them, you know, or promising them one thing and then not delivering and so forth, as we see in the film.
Right.
And then the other side of that is Lisa Fisher, who just said, whatever, you know, I'm happy singing and I'm just happy living my life. And she is exactly the way you see her in that film. That is the person. So
exactly. She's also my Facebook friend. Yay!
Oh, yeah. She's so happy to say she's a friend of mine. She's
excellent.
Such a lovely person and incredibly talented.
Well, for you, it seems as though once you were ready, you decided to come forward.
Yeah. At that time, you know, when many of my colleagues, and boy, I tell you, there's so many, the film focused on a few people because it has to, but there's so many people, and a lot of people in that film actually who had major label deals who, you know, had the same thing happen to. They had a success for a moment and then, you know, not so much after that. But I really wanted to make sure that I could do the material that I wanted to do and record what I wanted to record. And at the point when, you know, I had been offered years and years ago, I was working with the great producer and musician Diodato and doing a bunch of work for him years and years ago. And so a label had approached me also and said, oh, you know, we'd like to sign you with this material. And I thought, well, I'm not sure I can do that, you know. So I had had a few offers before, but it was just material that I didn't think that I wanted to make a career out of. So I just continued being happy backup singing rather than being not happy with a major deal and doing material that I wasn't necessarily in love with. So not that it wasn't good, just just wasn't, you know, something I wanted to really do for the rest of my life. And I knew that when you sign on to something, people connect memories to that stuff. So if you have a hit with something, you're going to be singing it for the rest of your life.
Oh, goodness.
So you better like it. You know, and I've worked with a few artists who try to change horses midstream as far as not singing their first hit or their second hit or whatever, and you can't do that. That's what the people are coming to hear. So
right.
Once that's formed, that's it. People play those songs at their weddings. They play them, you know, and so that's, you know, that's what they're coming to hear. And so fortunately, yes, things did happen for me at the, you know, at the right time, the right way, and I got the kind of support that allows me to have complete creative freedom. So, you know,
now,
I'm happy about that.
Now, you were talking about, you know, doing something and people being used to it and what have you, and it reminded me of a conversation I had with Joe Sample, and we had talked about him playing on a Steely Dan recording, and
yes.
I noticed you did some work with Steely Dan as well, and
yes.
they sort
yes.
of like everything to be exactly as the recording. Did you have that experience when you were singing backup?
They are very precise mm-hmm. in the studio.
Okay.
In the recording studio, you do things a number of times, and they pick what they, you know, and you'll do
sure.
it until you get the right feel for them.
Sure.
And but when you listen to the records, you understand why that is, you
mm-hmm.
know, and because it's a certain sound, it's a certain what we call pocket. It's
mm-hmm.
a certain way of feeling the material. It's a certain emphasis on certain lyrics. It's a certain way of forming the notes. And so that's why those recordings sound the way they do, you know.
Right.
And so I found it, and I still find it because I still do work with them. I find it educational and inspiring rather than stifling, you know.
Okay.
I just feel like it's its own brand of music, and there's a reason for it, you know.
Right.
So I like to learn, you know,
uh-huh.
and it's a great thing. It's beautiful music. I've been
sure.
a Steely Dan fan since, you know, the early 70s, so.
Wow, yes, and that's what I do like about Steely Dan, the sound. They have a sound. It's like you can
yes.
hear something and know this is Steely Dan.
Exactly, you know,
yeah.
and they pick the best people because
yeah.
the best people can go in there and give them stellar performances,
right.
you know, and the music is on such a high level, the songwriting is on such a high level that,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just incredible to be a part of that.
Thank you.
Now, in 2006, how were you approached to release Cat?
Well, we actually, in 2004, I came back. I was on David Bowie world tour, and we came back from Germany in, I think, May of 2004. And then it was kind of like you get home from a long tour. It was a very long tour. It was almost a year long. And my manager, Paul, said, well, what are you going to do now, you know? And I said, I don't know, you know. He said, why don't you make your own album? And I said, all right, I really am not, you know, don't know what I, how to, you know, how I want to do that. And he said, I'll just pick what you like, you know. And we had kind of talked about a concept which was really music of the early 20th century when African Americans were playing stringed instruments, violins and banjos, and all that stuff was really a part of early American jazz, early jazz. And so I kind of had an idea of a swing string band because I also was a fan of Dan Hicks for many years and I liked what he did. And so I said, well, let me just pick 12 or 14 tunes that I like. And then Paul had a friend outside of Chicago who is also a multi-instrumentalist, violin, mandolin, and producer, music producer also. He's produced many albums. And he has a studio. So he said, well, I think I can put this together with my friend. You pick the tunes, and I'll get my friend to co-produce this with me. He'll put the musicians together. And that's basically what happened. So we went out there in the winter of 2005. And that's exactly what we did. We recorded however many tunes we recorded in 3 days, then put that together, and then I was doing a show at my church, which is St. Peter's Church in New York City, and it's a jazz ministry. So
I was just going to ask you whether that was the jazz church.
It's 53rd. The jazz church.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they have an ongoing jazz series on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. So I was doing one of those concerts, and Paul invited a couple of record labels to hear me. And then the next day we were sitting down with the president of Harmonia Mundi, what is now Jazz Village, talking about a record contract. So that's actually how that happened. And then they helped me put out the first album, which is Cat. Mm-hmm. And so that turned into that. And then we have been making an album every 2 years ever since. So.
Yes, you have. It's exactly been every 2 years. Was that the plan? It was like clockwork.
Well, it's you know, in 2 years, it's kind of time to make a new album.
Okay.
So after you've toured an album, that's my feeling anyway. I don't know, you know, about others, but
sure.
After I have been touring an album for a year and a half, people start going, okay, where's the next one? Where's the next one? And then by that time also, I have, because as soon as I finish one album, I'm looking at material for the next one. You know, I'm always hunting for material. So by the time about a year comes around, I have gathered enough generally for the next album, and I've been trying it in my shows, and I put songs into shows before I record them just to see how they're going to go over with an audience and see if they're fun to play and see if the band likes them, see if, you know, see what happens. So that's about the time span when it's time to go back in, you know.
Okay.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for March 9th. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. There are no upcoming New York City metro area shows for tonight's guest, Catherine Russell, but check her website at catherinerussell.net for updates, and we'll list anything we hear for you here. But there are other shows for you to catch this week. Organist Akiko Tsuruga continues her regular Monday night gig at Manhattan's Kotobuki Restaurant. Catch her there March 10th and 17th. Details are at kotobukiNewYork.com. I'll give that to you one more time. That's KOTOBUKI NewYork.com. There's a free midday event on the legacy of pianist Mary Lou Williams, sponsored by Columbia University's Jazz Studies Institute, on the 12th. Pianists Vijay Iyer and Jerry Allen join Professor Farah Jasmine Griffin to talk about her life and music. It's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. in Buell Hall's East Gallery on Columbia's campus. Details are at jazz.columbia.edu. That's jazz.columbia.edu. Also this week, pianist Jerry Allen celebrates Mary Lou Williams with a performance of Music and Words at Harlem Stage from March 13th to 15th. Go to harlemstage.org. That's harlemstage.org. Looking ahead to next week, organist John Medeski will be at the Town Hall with John Zorn on March 19th. Also on the 19th, pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls Jazz Club. See smallsjazzclub.com for info on this show. Looking much further ahead, guitarist Pat Metheny's Unity Band has three area shows at the end of March to support their new album titled Kin. You can catch them at Red Bank, New Jersey at the Count Basie Theater on March 23rd, in Fairfield, Connecticut at Fairfield University's Quick Center for the Arts on the 25th, and in New York at the Town Hall Theater on the 28th. And I'll point you to Pat's website, which has links for all of the shows, at patmetheny.com, and click on the link for the schedule. That's patmetheny.com. If you're interested, you should get tickets right away, as Metheny shows sell out fast. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org, where you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We'll see you next week, March 16th, on the Bandstand.
Thank you, Hank Williams. And in spite of an email that I got that said that the drive was ending yesterday, Fun Drive is apparently still happening, and you can call 212-209-2950 to show your support for Sugar in My Bowl and WBAI on the whole. And I don't have a lot of time, but just to let you know, the playlist is up on sugarinmybowl.org. As mentioned, you can go there and find the playlist. If you like us on Facebook, Sugar in My Bowl, S-U-G-A apostrophe in my bowl, you can see the playlist there as well. So stay tuned for more. Catherine Russell. And if you have any questions about what you've heard, and you can call me at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, but what you need to call is 212-209-2950. Anyway, stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and Catherine Russell.
This is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
So after Cat, there was Sentimental Streak, and then Inside This Heart of Mine.
Yes, and then Strictly Romance.
Yes.
And then after
yes.
That, yes.
Yes, and then Bring It Back.
And then Bring It Back.
Your most recent.
Yes.
I guess, you know, there's one thing I really, really enjoy you doing. I know you could swing. Yes, you could do anything. And
oh,
I think,
appreciate that.
And I'm actually wondering, is it because you did the background work? I know it probably prepared you for everything.
You know, each thing feeds the other thing. So mm-hmm. I find that, and I was actually singing lead with bands, just not doing my own recording. You know, mm-hmm. I did a lot of work with you know, soul bands and blues bands. And,
okay.
You know, so I did build up my lead singing chops, you know, before I started recording my albums. But swing is a thing that I've loved my whole life. Like bands that swing and music that swings. I've always loved swing era mm-hmm. music. I've always loved listening to Louis Armstrong. I've mm-hmm. always loved music for dancing, you know, and jitterbugging and watching people on the dance floor and big bands and all that type of thing and Count Basie and all that. So I have always sought that type of thing. And then so when I started making albums, I was in search of musicians that love to swing.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of how these musicians that I've recorded with and work with now has developed. I just was in search of kindred spirits in loving swing and loving that pocket, loving to swing. And that's kind of my style in jazz, you know. So it's a different style, of course, in soul music and in blues. But everything, I like a pulse. I like music that's danceable, and I like things that you can shake your hips to. That's just what I like, you know, that you can, you want to move to, you know, because when your body's involved, it's a happy thing, you know. People are happy when they can tap their feet and snap their fingers and things like that. So that type of thing makes me happy, and it's also helped me develop as a vocalist.
Where I was actually going was how I really love how you swing a ballad.
Thank you.
You swing a ballad. I mean, on Strictly Romancing, Under the Spell of the Blues, I think that's the opening track.
Yes, it is.
It is just amazing. I mean, and you seem to treat a lot of your songs. The most recent, I Cover the Waterfront.
Oh, yeah.
Away from the city that hurts and mocks, I'm standing alone by the desolate docks. In the still and the chill of the night, I see the horizon, that great unknown. My heart has an ache, it's as heavy as stone. Will the dawn coming on make it light? I cover the waterfront. I'm watching the sea. Will the one I love be coming back? Betsy, in my misery, I say that I'm satisfied. No use to hide what goes on inside. It's true, my heart is under the spell of the
how I'm going to phrase something. Mm. And I love the kind of push-pull of swing and how you can back phrase it and then speed it up and slow it down and kind of work off of the musicians, you know, and mm-hmm. what they're doing. And also what the lyric is doing, what the story of the song is doing.
I see.
So that all of those elements really inform how I tell the story of the song, you know, so I'm not really thinking about that as I'm doing it, but I'm just kind of reacting to the whole thing and trying to just speak to the listener, pretty much.
So who handles the arrangements?
Well, all different people, actually. Most of the horn arrangements are tenor saxophonist Andy Farber, who's a New Yorker, and he's a great arranger and has done a bunch of work with Wynton Marsalis, does it, and actually is playing in the Broadway show After Midnight right now.
Oh, okay.
And so when I wanted a horn arranging, he called me to do this Fats Waller tribute show, which I couldn't do because I was on the road. And then a little while after that, he called me and he said, I want to meet with you because I'd like to arrange for you. So that was kind of a blessing to
wow.
me. So we met. And then I said, oh, great. Well, how about this, and this? I gave him a bunch of tunes, you know, to arrange, and we talked about that, which turned into what you hear on Strictly Romancing. And then John Eric Kelso, the great trumpeter who lives also in New York City and works in Vince Giordano's Nighthawks, is
okay.
another great, great horn arranger. So he did some arrangements for me. Matt Munisteri, my musical director and guitar player for several years now, does, you know, a lot of arranging for me. And so I would say, primarily those three individuals, and then I got to do a very simple horn arrangement on Aged and Mellow on the new album. So that was mine. I can take a little credit.
Hey, you speaking know. Of credit, composing credit, you wrote on the first. You wrote Blue Memories.
Paul and I co-wrote Blue Memories, and
okay.
then I wrote a song called Lucy. And that was on Sentimental Streak, and I was encouraged to, I haven't written that many songs, but
right.
Lucy was one of those songs that everything came to me in about 15 minutes
okay.
one night. The whole thing, it just came to me, all the words, the melodies, the everything. And I'd come home from a gig, and all of a sudden, bam, there was the song. And that never happened to me before or since.
Wow.
you spending money that's not your own. You second guess when you know you're right. Sleep through the day and stay out all night. From the frying pan into the fire, you're doing a dance on the high wire. There is no end to the work you'll do to break the chains she has on you. She's waiting, yeah, waiting on you. No matter what you do, she's waiting. Waiting on. Your every need, she'll get the job done in light speed. Free your mind, even form your thoughts. Find your strength, multiply your force. Trying to fight the powers that be, but you're never really in control. You see, there is no end to the work you do to break the hold she has on you. She is a
Latin, you
oh.
know, so I don't really judge what the genre is.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of let the muse do its thing, and then it is what it is. So that was a Latin tune first. It had a Latin feel. And then I played it for Bernie Worrell,
yeah.
you know, of Parliament Funkadelic fame, and he really liked it, so he demoed it, and then it turned into a soul tune when
wow.
he demoed it, and he just kind of funkifies the whole thing for me, and that was amazing. And then I was encouraged to put it on this album, and then it turned into, I don't know, country, soul, funk, I don't know what it is, but it just turned into something very haunting as a result of Larry Campbell's and the Levon Helm band. And Byron Isaac's bass playing and Larry Campbell's incredibly haunting pedal steel playing. And so it was just kind of turned into that. You know, I didn't decide what that was going to sound like before we played it. Mm-hmm. But I love the way it came out. But, you know, it's not really jazz, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, so it's kind of...
It's music, yeah. Blessed it.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, I've written other things. I've written music to poetry, and I've written other things, but they pretty much are soul-oriented, you know. When I write a song, that's kind of how I feel it, you know, when I'm writing stuff. So.
Sure. Did you write for Cyndi Lauper?
Yes, we co-wrote a tune called Hot Gets a Little Cold.
Mm.
And, yeah.
In 1, 2, 3... is just a great anticipation. It's starring in that picture show. Let's wait until the credits roll. Heart gets a little cold. And heart gets a little cold.
Idea, and we sat in her apartment one afternoon and wrote it.
Mm.
And so I thank you for reminding. I forgot about that. You know, she's still, you know, a friend and a colleague, and
great.
And I was in her band for years in the 90s, and I'm just so happy for her. And I went to see Kinky Boots, and it was incredible. Yeah.
Now, I understand another person I think you probably still work with, Roslyn Cash?
Roseanne Cash,
Roseanne,
yes.
Cash, Lord Jesus.
Yes, I have worked with Roseanne, I'm so happy to say, for many, many years, and recorded with her on several albums, and recorded on this newest album, and she is just incredible, incredible beautiful songwriter, and her newest album is probably, to me, some of her finest work.
What's that called?
The River and the Thread. And we sang on, I think, 3 or 4 cuts on that. Like A Feather's Not a Bird.
Okay.
Is the first one, and 50,000 Watts of Common Prayer is another one, and The Sunken Lands, just beautiful. In the Mississippi Delta. She and her husband and co-writer John Leventhal, actually the cover photo is Roseanne on the banks of the Tallahatchie Bridge, and they just went down south and just took a trip down there, and all these tunes came out of that trip.
Wow.
And so I think it's just amazing how people can be inspired. She's an incredible, incredible songwriter. So, and also a very good friend of mine for, I don't know, 20-something years now, so.
Excellent. Now, I've got to tell you something about your latest release, Bring It Back.
Yes.
It
was released the 11th of February.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the Darktown Strutters Ball.
Yes.
I generally, when I hear that song, all sorts of bad things run through my head.
Because, that's right.
Because of the connotation. But I love this.
I you see, that's why I did it, because it was done so much, it's so widely recorded, everybody knows the tune, and it did have those bad connotations, and actually, it's a happy song.
Yes.
It's a good song, it's a happy song, and it's about people having a good time.
Right, right.
Thank you.
Strutter's ball, it's a very swell affair. All the highbrows will be there. You wear your high silk hat and a frock tail coat. I wear my Paris gown and my new silk shawl. Ain't no doubt about it, babe, we'll be the best dressed in the hall. I'll be down to get Jay in the taxi, honey. Better be ready about 8:30. Oh, darling, don't be late. I want to be there when the band starts playing. Remember when we get there, honey. Two steps, I'm going to have them all. I'm going to dance out, hold them my shoes. When they play the Jelly Roll Blues. Tomorrow night at the Knocktown Strutter's Ball.
Orchestra, and actually my father also did a version of it, you know, along with about 30 other versions of it.
Uh-huh.
And I heard her version and I said, you know, this is really a fun song.
Mm.
This is really fun. And then I had the sheet music and people don't normally do the verse to it. And so I decided to do the verse because I love, you know, a lot of old tunes have verses that people don't do. So
right.
I always look for the verse. And I just said, you know what, let me just take the spell off this thing because it's a good song. I really like it.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
And people actually, you know, do enjoy hearing it, you know, when we do it in the shows. So it's fun.
I really appreciate it. I got to tell you yet again,
oh,
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
And you have a song that was written by your father on here, Lucille?
Yes, Lucille. I'm very happy about this tune because we found it, kind of, it was like a happy accident, you know, but not really when I think about it. We were visiting the Louis Armstrong Archive at Queens College, and it's time mm-hmm. for me to go back there because as soon as I walked in there, I was just laughing, like I was so happy to be mm. there, like going home. So we went to the archive, Paul and myself. And Ricky Riccardi, who is just an angel, he's the, you know, runs the archive over there and is also a great author of later Louis Armstrong's career, wrote a book called It's a Wonderful World about that.
Okay.
Great book. So he's showing us around, and I'm just as happy as, you know, anything. And so at one point he says, listen, I have something that I want you to listen to because I need to identify the people. So what he had was a digitized, you know, converted from a reel-to-reel tape. And so he put the thing on, and as soon as the music started, it was organ accompaniment, and the vocalist started singing, and it was my mother.
Oh, wow.
And the organist was a fellow Panamanian friend of my dad's named Frank Anderson. They worked together back in the 1950s because my dad had run a club in Brooklyn and Frank had a band that my mother worked in, and they, you know, it's all kinds
wow.
of you know, all kinds of stuff going on, and the club was called Town Hill.
Okay.
So they had demoed three songs and submit them to Louis Armstrong with the intention of having him record them, which he never did. But Louis Armstrong luckily kept everything. So he kept these tunes, and there are three tunes, three demos, and so Lucille is the first one that we've demoed, dedicated to Louis Armstrong's, I think, fourth wife, Lucille mm-hmm. Armstrong. And it's a beautiful standard. So we actually have found a standard that's never been recorded. You know, it's never been done. So I'm going to do the other two as well.
Excellent.
Yeah, so then we started, I had Andy Farber, once again, do a horn arrangement for that. So that's an original first-time horn arrangement for that tune. He did a beautiful arrangement. And we debuted that at Jazz at Lincoln Center in 2012. We did a show dedicated to Louis Armstrong and Louis Russell, and the tune went over well. Again, I, you know, have to test it in front of people before I record it. So people respond very well to that. So, you know, I was happy about that, so we put it on the album.
Well, this had to be a really magnificent thing for you, considering the lengths that you go to find new songs.
You know what? I love, it's really a joy for me to delve, you know, to just delve into, to get a collection. Paul, for Christmas, he got me a Chick Webb Ella Fitzgerald, you know, the big collection that's just been released.
Wow.
And it's unbelievable. It's like 200 songs or something.
Wow.
It's incredible how much these artists recorded. You know, you have no idea. These people were working continually. You know, so Louis Armstrong was recording. He'd do a radio show in the morning, go in to the recording studio and make an album in the afternoon, and then do a gig at night. You know, people have no idea how hard these artists worked. And so it's incredible the body of work that these people left. So I think that it's only fair that I go and delve into these people's catalogs and you know, and find all this incredible material.
Sure.
And a lot of it has only been done by them. So, you know, a lot of this Chick Webb, Ella Fitzgerald stuff that was recorded by them in the 30s hasn't been heard of since. You know, and this was before, this was the beginning of her career. And so, you know, and then all of the hundreds of songs that she pre-recorded after that, you know. So that's actually my favorite period of Ella Fitzgerald, though, the Chick Webb period. Yeah, so, you know, because she's swinging hard, too, back then. She's just young and swinging, man, you know. So it's great. It's just fabulous, you know,
beautiful,
to listen to. And they were also recording a lot of things that we know now as a Great American Songbook material, you know. So I found a couple of things by Irving Berlin on there that I'm going to learn, and a Sammy Kahn tune on there. So, you know, it's really fascinating. Fascinating, you know, that all of these worlds were just going right along together, because a lot of the Jewish writers, you know, were writing for black people.
Sure.
So it's a beautiful thing, you know.
I understand you also teach. Voice.
Yes.
Where do you teach?
Well, I taught at Berklee College of Music.
Oh, okay.
Back in the late 90s, and then actually had to leave there when I started working with David Bowie. But teaching is just wonderful. So since then, I've been teaching privately. I will help students, you know, put shows together, and I help them with material, you know, finding material, the right material for them. And, or I will work with them on their own original material and help them to get closer to their material, that, you know, which I've done a lot of as well. And then I also work with Michael Feinstein and the Great American Songbook Initiative. And what that is a competition for teenagers, for high school students every year, where they compete. We have regional competitions all over the country, and then a national competition in the summer. And they compete for money. They get a check to further their education and their performing or whatever they want to do, and then they're kind of ambassadors for a year, you know, the same as like a Miss America or something like that. They'll mentor others that are coming in. And so I've been a judge on that competition 3 times, and I plan to continue as long as they. It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. So I've done 1 national competition and 2 New York regional competitions, and I'm happy to say that the last 2 years, New York has won the national.
Woo-hoo!
And, So what that is we want to bring the next generation into preserving and performing and, you know, loving the classic material, you know, so.
How are the students brought to the competition?
They are either, you know, are studying in their respective high schools, you know, and a lot of them are in special music programs in those schools.
I see.
And then people enter them into the competition. So the word is put out, you know, every year to schools and to music camps and so forth. And so these young people are encouraged to enter. And then a lot of them enter, and then just a few are chosen to compete in the regional, so we'll have 10 maybe in the finalists in the regional, and then that is boiled down to 10 finalists for the national, and we'll either have one or two winners, you know, depending on if we feel we want a male and a female winner.
Okay.
And so forth, you know, because sometimes the contestants, it'll be more female-heavy than male-heavy and so forth. So we
I see.
To just, you know, make sure the things are balanced, you know. And they're incredible, incredibly talented. Oh, just incredibly inspiring. Yeah, you know, so all the mentors come out of there more inspired than the than the kids. And then the families, actually, so we have master classes. The national is maybe 3 or 4 days long, but the regionals are 1 day right now. So
okay.
We're trying to make those maybe a couple of days long. And so we have master classes all day, and we'll have little breakout groups and talk about, you know, connection to the lyric and just performance, stage presence, and that type of thing. And then in the evening, it's open to the public and to the families. And so we will do it at a theater, you know, so that everybody can come and cheer the people on and stuff like that.
This is the regional you're referring to, right?
Yes, this is the regional, and also for the national.
Okay.
It's also the same structure, just the national is more days. And so we just have a ball. We have a blast, you know, with the kids. And so they really, you know, they get all dressed up, but they just come out there like they're on Broadway. It's fantastic.
Excellent.
And they're all great. They're really talented singers. Really, really, really talented singers. So the judging is difficult because it's always a close race. It has been so far. There's always a kind of a long deliberation that happens with the judges.
You know,
because everybody's good. I'm happy to say.
Yay. Well, that's excellent. That is wonderful.
Yeah.
And why should they make your life easier? Why should they?
I know. It's great. It's great. So also what happens is that the winner gets to come and be on a show with Michael Feinstein in New York City. So I got to see the winner this year, the young woman that won the national, whom we chose, and I got to give her a hug, and she actually made an album. She actually recorded.
Really?
She's 16 years old.
And is her name?
Julia, and I know her first name is Julia, and she was really a beautiful singer. So she recorded, you know, It's a New Dawn, It's a New Day. And I got to give her a hug, and she's feeling good. That's a song that she won with.
Ooh.
Her last name is Goodwin. Julia Goodwin, Goodwin. The winner of the 2013 Great American Songbook Vocal Competition.
Well, congratulations, Julia Goodwin.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart. You know, it's also, you know, personality, and will they be okay in the world? You know, can they hold them? And it's the same kind of a thing. In any competition, you know, are you going to be a good ambassador and maintain your cool and, you know, all that kind of thing, you know? We always go and see Michael's shows in New York, and I was just so happy to see her come out there and just really take the bull by the horns. It was fantastic. You know, I was like a proud mama. You know, it was great.
That's great.
She was great, you know? So she did the whole run. I guess she did he was there for 2 weeks, so I believe she might have come and opened the show for him, you know, for the run.
Oh, beautiful. Wow.
Yeah. Or maybe at least half the run, I'm not sure.
But. Well, that's a great opportunity. However many times she did it.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And then you also see, then can they, you know, because singing in New York is a, you know, that's really the test. I mean,
it's
you
New
can,
York.
You know.
You can't make it here. You can't make it anywhere.
You know, so it's really amazing.
Well, that is wonderful. Now, are there any events that you want to let people know about that are coming up?
Well, we start to go out and tour this album. So we're going in March. We're going down and doing some shows in the Southeast. And then in April, we go out to the Midwest. So that's usually our, you know, we try to do all, you know, the pockets of the country, if we can, you know, these little tours and strings of dates. And then I have, now I'm going to get to do Rochester International Jazz Festival again.
Ooh, okay.
In June, which is great. And also, we've launched a show called Ladies Sing the Blues, which I've done at Jazz at Lincoln Center with vocalists Brianna Thomas and Charnay Wade. So the three of us. Yeah, really great, amazing singers and beautiful individuals. And we put together a show of music basically of the 20s. So all, you know, blues women, Ida Cox, Bessie Smith, Ethel Waters, and some that, you know, Alberta Hunter, and some Margaret Johnson and Virginia Liston, some that are not as well known to the general population. And we do that with a 7-piece little orchestra. So we have 3 horns, and so we have basically stuck to the original arrangements from the recordings, you know. Mm. So that is a show that actually Charnay and I will be doing in Savannah in March, so I'm looking forward to that. And so we're trying to tour that as well, so we're really working on that because there doesn't seem to be a show like that that's traveling right now. And there used to be, you know, when Linda Hopkins and Carrie Smith and Ruth Brown and Alberta Hunter herself.
Right.
And all of these ladies, Barbara Morris, and all of these ladies were doing these types of shows. So we're trying to carry that tradition on as well. So that's what's happening, you know? So I'm just looking forward to everything. I got a bunch of stuff coming up. And
is that show coming back here to New York, the one that you're
doing? Well, we are working on doing that. We actually did that in, let me see, we did it, did we do it in October? I think we did it in October at the Allen Room in Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Okay.
And then we did it at Dizzy's Club in January.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure when we're going to do it in New York again. But, you know, and then there's also another project that had been working on with my mother years and years ago, which is the great band leader and arranger Cy Oliver.
Oh.
Who did a lot of work for Jimmy Lunsford and Tommy Dorsey and a lot of, you know, swing era bands as well, and had his own great orchestra that my mother actually played bass in. She was, I think, maybe the only female musician in that outfit. Cy Oliver had written vocal quartet arrangements for On the Sunny Side of the Street and Ain't She Sweet and different tunes from back in the day. And so he had rearranged a bunch of these tunes for the three of us, for my mother and his wife, Lillian Clark, and myself. So I have those arrangements, and that might be my next project, is to record those arrangements with a vocal trio. And for my mother's celebration of life back in November, I did one of them with my fellow Steely Dan singers, Carolyn Lenhart and LaTanya Hall. And the people really responded well to that. So I think that I'm going to be working on that pretty soon, too, because we have 8 of Cy Oliver's original arrangements. So I have those in my possession. And
beautiful.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm just having a ball, man. Just
that
like
you are.
Delving back into the history.
So one last question.
Yes.
Bring It Back.
Yes.
Why is the release titled Bring It Back?
You know, the album titles are usually not my decision, but it seems that this seemed to be the easiest. Everybody kind of agreed that that's what it should be called for some reason. And I was looking, you know, kind of into, you know, when I'm making records, I go, okay, well, I have this type of thing now. Maybe I need some blues here. Maybe I need some rhythm and blues. Maybe I need a little more of this, a little more of that. So listening to Wynonie Harris on a plane and heard Bring It Back, and I thought, yeah, this is a good tune. I like this tune, you know. And then put it in the shows. So the record label, Paul, everybody, just kind of when we were doing it, they agreed that it should open the album, and then they agreed that that's what it should be called, because we're just kind of bringing it back to simplicity, I think, you know, to, I don't know, simpler times, love and music and swing, and that's kind of the theme of my musical life, I think.
Excellent. Oh, by the way, I wanted to tell you, the Dogtown Strutters, I also felt good about the fact that Alberta Hunter recorded it. So that helped me embrace it a little more.
Yes, and I also listened to her version. Thank you for reminding me of that. I also listened to her version of it, and I thought, yeah, okay, it's fine. You know, it's fine, because they were recording that back then.
Right.
You know, so, and she recorded a lot of, oh my goodness, what is the, It Makes No Difference After Dark, you know, about, you know, maybe the man liking a lighter skinned woman.
Uh-oh.
And then, you know, but when we're, when the lights are out, who cares, basically, is the gist of the tune, you know. And so, you know, there's a lot of, we were recording a lot of things like that, and Louis Armstrong, I recall, was told that he should take the verse out of something because Darkies was in the verse.
Mm.
And he said, but that's a song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how they wrote that, you
right.
know, so he sang it.
Right.
And then they said, no, you know, people are going to get upset, so don't.
Well, I don't know. I can't say that I would embrace some song using Darkies these days.
No, it's a tough, it's a tough thing. You can't still really sing that. You know?
Right.
You know, but, you know.
But Darktown Strutters, we're a step closer there.
Darktown Strutters, and then there's Sugarfoot Strut too. Some people get a little bit upset about that because that's got an old lyric as well. But he recorded that with the Hot Sevens, and you know, it's basically about sweet potatoes or something. You know, it's about food. So.
Of course, it's for the foodies.
Yeah. So you know. There's one other thing that I should mention. The movie, there's a film called The Girls in the Band.
Yes.
That talks about, at the point, there's one member still alive, actually, who is Roz Kron. And I believe she's a saxophonist. She played saxophone with the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. And it focuses primarily on female jazz instrumentalists and the tough time that, you know, female instrumentalists have, you know, and particularly in jazz and in orchestras back in the day. And then focused on my mother and Roz Kron being people that were survivors, people that were still alive that could be interviewed for this film. And Marion McPartland is also a star in the film. So it's a good piece of historical film, and it's traveling around the country. It doesn't have a run any one place, but if you see it in the theater near you, please go and support it because it's a really good film, just like, you know, 20 Feet from Stardom. It's an important film that's been made and, you know, educational for people who want to know more about female instrumentalists. And Mom is a big part of that film.
Thank you so much for mentioning that because you reminded me of my question.
Oh,
is there a plan in the works of you to write anything about your mother and father?
Yes, you know, they left me with an archive that is going to take me probably, I don't want to say the rest of my life, but it's going to take me probably 5 years at least to compile and get something physical out, you know, as far as both of their legacies, because what we have acquired, they saved everything as well. So so thank goodness for that.
Yes.
Because what we have are materials that no one else has, you know, on both of them. So we have begun to digitize a bunch of stuff, and we do plan to make a film, documentary film, and also in book form, you know, whether it's a coffee table book of just mostly photos and descriptions of those or something. So, yes, there will be physical product available as soon as we can compile that. So that is what we are continually working on right now. We've been working on it since my mother's transition last July. So it's a great wealth of material. It's just amazing. So I feel so fortunate that they kept everything, you know. So
yes.
I have stuff dating back to the 1920s.
Oh, that is wonderful.
It's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, your work is cut out for you.
Yes, and happily so.
Yes.
Happily so.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine Russell. I really appreciate all of this time that you spent with us.
Well, Joyce, thank you so much for talking to me for so long. I appreciate it, you know, and hopefully I'll meet you in person at some point.
Hopefully.
Lucille, you make my day begin. Whatever mood I'm in depends on you, Lucy.
All right, we need to get out of here. Oh yeah, 212-209-2950. Apparently the drive is still happening, so then there you have it. If you could actually give that number a call, let people know that you like Sugar My Bowl, you appreciated this evening's program, then and pledge your support because we need your help. This is Lucille from Bring It Back.
the latest from Catherine Russell, released on February 11th, 2014. Before that, we heard Darktown Strutters Ball. The Darktown Strutters Ball from the same release, Bring It Back. Before that, we heard A Feather's Not a Bird, Roseanne Cash from The River and the Thread, which was released in January of this year on Blue Note Records. Hot Gets a Little Cold, which was written by Catherine Russell. Cyndi Lauper from Sisters of Avalon, 1997 Epic Records. Let's see what we got. How many minutes we got here? Oh, goodness, I don't even have the thing in front of me. We don't have a lot of time, but as I mentioned, the everything's on the playlist, and the playlist is at sugarinmybowl.org, sugainmybowl.org. And if you join us on Facebook, you will find out when we're coming on and who's going to be our guest, and the playlist is usually there, too. And let's see, Under the Spell of the Blues was before Lucy from Strictly Romancin'. I Cover the Waterfront from Bring It Back. Let's see, before that, The Last Mall, Steely Dan, Everything Must Go. He's All I Need, which is what Catherine Russell did with her mother, Carlene Ray, from Strictly Romancin'. Lazarus, Carlene Ray, was produced by Catherine Russell in 2013, available on CD Baby. One and Our Father from Mary Lou Williams' Mary Lou's Mass, 2003 Smithsonian Folkways reissue. And let's see, before that, New Call of the Freaks by Lewis Russell and his orchestra. And let's see, before that, we heard Louis Armstrong, You Got Me Voodooed, November from Inside This Heart of Mine. Time to go. La Nueva Alternativa, next.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.